Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the IEA School of Thought series with me, Sai Kamal. I'm the Academic and Research Director at the Institute of Economic Affairs in London. This series is based on an IEA book, School of Thought, 101 Great Liberal Thinkers by Eamon Butler, which, as the title suggests, summarises the thoughts of leading classical liberal thinkers on a range of issues, and we discuss them within a modern context. Now, today's featured thinker is Catholic historian and writer Lord Acton. And to discuss his work and his life, I'm delighted to be joined by Clemens Schneider, who is director of Prometheus, a classical liberal think tank based in Germany. But also, Clemens is writing his PhD thesis on Lord Acton. So, Clemens, thank you very much. Welcome, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a big honour and pleasure to be with a big sister in London.
We see ourselves as a sort of the mothership or the granddaddy of the classical liberal movement. But both genders hopefully satisfied there. So let's start with Lord Acton. Of course, you're writing your PhD thesis on him. So I normally ask our guests, why did you pick him? But what is it about Lord Acton that fascinates you enough for you to want to write your PhD about him? Did he have a profound impact on you specifically? Do you admire the role that he played in shaping our thinking? What is it about him that stands out for you?
Well, it has some personal reasons because I'm a Catholic theologian. So I had this Catholic background and was looking for someone who might bring together the Catholic background and my liberal convictions. And I suddenly stumbled upon Lord Acton and I thought, well, that is a perfect fit. And as I came to know him and read his writings and also came to know him sort of personally through reading his letters, going through the archives in Cambridge and stuff, I really got close to him. And he's, in the meantime, like a friend over time, because I can find so many similarities, so many similar thoughts, so many things that we have in common. And it's like really great to getting to know him and growing to be his friend over time.
And what is it about him that makes him stand out for you, that, you know, grabs you more than, say, some of the other thinkers? I know you've got a personal connection through your own Catholicism and your own liberalism, but what is it that stands out for you?
Well, one thing that really fascinates me about him is that he's a little bit like a truffle-hunting dog. So through the history of ideas, which is one of his major concerns, exploring the history of ideas, especially the history of liberty, there are so many interesting characters and people who really have very intriguing thoughts, but who have been forgotten by history. People who have expressed ideas in the late ancient times, which have only been developed properly after the Enlightenment, for example. And Acton is really good in finding them. And he's like hunting through the history of ideas like this truffle hunting dog. And he finds, just to give you some examples, people like Vincent of Lerins, who's a late antiquity Christian theologian and was the big antagonist of Saint Augustine, who is certainly a protagonist of the not liberal Catholic way of thinking. And Vincent, as opposed to this, has done a lot to develop the idea of conscience, for example, and a free will. Acton concerns himself with the free church movement in Europe in the 17th century, finding people like Fausto Sozzini, an Italian theologian who emigrated to Poland because he was persecuted in Italy in those days. And he explores his thoughts, who are really revolutionary for those times. He looks at somebody like the Jesuit mathematician Alfonso Sarasa, who develops the idea of conscience, but is not known by anybody now. Or the Swiss-French Protestant priest Alexandre Vinet, who tries to baptize Kant and tries to bring Kant into a Christian context. So he's really good in finding those extraordinary and forgotten thinkers in history. And he himself is also a very somebody who's thinking out of the box. He's very independent. He's very innovative. And I think it's so delightful to meet all these things in his works and these thinkers and these ideas, which you wouldn't have thought that they had existed and which still are very, very normal for us nowadays, but haven't been in their time.
So you mentioned all these thinkers that he's hunted out, if you like, and is reintroduced to the world in many ways. But was he particularly inspired by any of them in particular, or were there other thinkers that inspired his own thinking?
Well, I'd basically say there are four big figures in his ideas and in his thinking that have been of significant importance. The first one would be Edmund Burke, of course, the big British politician, historian, philosopher. And he has a close connection to Burke also because he's a very historically minded person, and so was Burke. And the ideas of development, of evolution, which are to be found in Burke, are also very present in Acton's own work. The second major influence was Ignaz von Döllinger, who was a Munich-based German church historian and was sort of a father figure for Acton, who had lost his father at a very young age. And he took him in when he was 16. And so he grew up in this household of this very, very educated, refined professor. And he was one of the major figures for him, influencing his thought, also, of course, his Catholic approach, but also his liberal mindedness, which was quite common in those days in German intellectual circles. And the third person I already mentioned is Alexandre Vigny, this Protestant priest from Switzerland who tried to bring Kant into the Christian context. And the fourth big figure is, a little bit surprisingly maybe, but Acton is always very good for surprises, the English writer George Eliot. He absolutely loved George Eliot because he said she manages to bring basic Christian ideas of morality into the modern context, which is secular, which is de-Christianized. And so she saves the core elements of Christianity by bringing them into a new context. And he really admired that.
And when you look at, you know, look back at his work, and you look at the whole, if you like, the classical liberal narrative today, how influential do you think Lord Acton has been in helping to shape that whole classical liberal narrative, and maybe not only the classical liberal narrative, but political thought as a whole?
Well, not very, to be honest, which has several reasons. One of them being, or the, maybe the major one being, that he never wrote a book. His big project for all times was writing the history of liberty. And it's not a big surprise that he didn't succeed, especially considering that he had this truffle hunting dog instinct. So he would bury himself into certain issues for months and wouldn't really get ahead with his big project. So all that he left for us is many essays, lectures he gave when he was professor in Cambridge, a huge pile of notes. So if you go to the Cambridge University Library, you can ramble through those hundreds of boxes with thousands of notes that are extremely interesting, but he never managed to compile the stuff. And that's the reason why nowadays he's not very well known anymore. Whereas in his lifetime, he was a very prominent figure. He wasn't only highly intellectual, but he was also very sociable. So he loved the company of people. He was keeping company with very different circles around Europe, not just in Britain, but also in Germany, in France, and Italy. So he was well known in those days, but nowadays a lot of his thought has, well, been buried again in libraries. But there is one thinker who has really been deeply influenced by Acton, and that is Friedrich August von Hayek, the Austrian economist and social philosopher. I just checked that before. There are actually, in the major works of Hayek, you have some quotes at the beginning of each chapter. And in the Road to Serfdom, four of those quotes are from Acton. Nobody else is quoted as often. In the Constitution of Liberty 3 and in Law and Legislation and Liberty, at least the first chapter has a quote of Acton. And also when you look into whom he is mentioning, I think besides Hume, Tocqueville, Smith, and Mises, nobody is mentioned as often by Hayek as Lord Acton. So Hayek really, really appreciated him, and a lot of Hayek's thought has roots in the thinking of Lord Acton.
Now, I really realise you alluded to this earlier, but when we often interview for this series, we find that thinkers fall into one of two camps. either they struggled to get their ideas heard at the time, only to be vindicated later, or they made an immediate impact, and either that faded away, or they're still having an impact today. Where would you say that Lord Acton falls?
Well, I think his impact as Lord Acton was much bigger at his lifetime. So a lot of historians, a lot of public intellectuals were really close to him and interested in his thinking, especially the wonderful, great William Gladstone. The two were really, really good friends, and Acton was maybe one of his closest advisors. So his influence was not on policy as such, but on the policy makers. And that was a big influence in those days. Nowadays, he's more influential through the people whom he influenced himself. So not directly, it's not that people refer to Lord Acton, but they refer to people who have learned by Lord Acton, as well economists and social philosophers as historians too.
Now, you talk about his friendship or his respect, mutual respect with Lord, with Gladstone. He dabbled in politics for a while. He was actually a politician for a short time. But how did that go? How was he a good politician, or was it too brief and he went back to thinking and being a historian?
It didn't work at all. So he was born into a politician's family, actually, and a strongly political family. His grandfather on his father's side was the last prime minister of the Kingdom of Sicily for, I think, 30 years. And his mother's uncle was the last chancellor of the Holy Roman Empire. So he too was one of the most influential people of his time. So he had certainly a lot of heritage on the policy side. Also, his mother married a very influential British politician of those days, Gosson Lauer, I think, Lord Grey, who was foreign minister and minister of finance and stuff. So he should have been a very political person, but he wasn't at all. He was once elected to parliament, twice elected to parliament, but never actually, I think he gave two speeches and was a backbencher as they come. And very quickly realized that this sphere was not at all for him. He was a thinker. He was a very sensitive person who didn't like the rough business of politics that much.
Well, I think as a former politician who's now a think tank, I think I can identify with that myself. When you look at his ideas, and you know, we're classical liberals very much in the 21st century, you know, and many people, when we look back, were very much men of their time. Are there areas where, when you come, you know, looked at his works and his writings and his thoughts, that you think, well, actually, I disagree with that? Or does it still make a lot of sense to you?
Well, there are some parts of his thought where I would disagree with, and probably people could have disagreed with already in his time, especially when it comes to economics. So he wasn't at all a very good economist. Neither privately, he was bankrupt at the age of 50, I think, nor as it comes to ideas. And he rarely concerned himself with economics. And when he did, it was very, it was a layman's perspective to say that. So I would disagree with a lot of things he's writing in those fields, but luckily that's not the main focus he was writing about. But I think that even nowadays, there's one very important contribution we should think about and we should consider. And that's the genesis and the history of ideas. So he considered himself a historian of ideas, and he showed how important it is to understand nowadays discourse, nowadays politics, nowadays public opinion, through how it developed. So you can only understand what people talk about and think about, and you can understand how to influence that if you know the history of ideas. And I have a quote which I'd like to share with you, which nails it very nicely, I think. He once wrote to Gladstone's daughter, with whom he had a very intense and friendly conversation. Ideas have a radiation and development, an ancestry and posterity of their own, in which men play the part of godfathers and godmothers more than that of legitimate parents. So the point he's getting at is that these ideas are so powerful that they cannot be properly controlled. I mean, we can be godmothers and godfathers, mind you, he gendered himself, but we cannot influence them as a whole. So we are also always in a context of ideas that move forward without us being able to properly control them. But we can try to work with them and understand them. And I think that is something beautiful, which also people like Hayek or others have explored, the humility towards our own influence and how things work, but also the responsibility we have in being godparents.
Yes, it also reminds me of a quote. I can't remember who it was, and I'm going to misquote it, so maybe one of the listeners or viewers can write in and correct us. But it's something like, you can stop the invasion of armies, but you can't stop the flow of ideas. A lovely way of putting it. And of course, both of us being at think tanks, we understand the importance of the battle of ideas. Yeah. What do we know about Lord Acton in his personal life? Was he married? Was he a family man? Was he a happy family man? What do we know about him? Friendship circles?
I think one very significant feature of him was that he was a cosmopolitan man. As I mentioned before, his grandfather was the last prime minister of Sicily, the Kingdom of Sicily, which also included southern Italy. So he was born in Naples. And he always felt a close affinity to Italy too. But then he moved to Paris at a young age when his father died, lived in Paris with his mother for a while because his grandparents on his mother's side were peers of France, although they were German by descent. And then he moved to Britain to go to boarding school. And then at the age of 16, he moved to Munich, where he started studying and he met his wife, who was a Bavarian. And then he spent most of his life between Munich, Bavaria, France, Nice, and Britain, traveling a lot, living in Rome, for example, for a couple of years when the Vatican Council was going on. So just a couple of days ago, the decisive moment of the Vatican Council had its 150th anniversary, where Lord Acton was involved a lot because the dogma of infallibility was proclaimed 150 years ago. And Acton was one of the main figures in Rome trying to organize the resistance against this dogma. So he was getting German and American and British and French bishops together to try to stop this dogma from being pronounced. So he was always around and about. He was also a family man. He had six children, four of whom I think survived childhood. And he loved company. He was really somebody who loved to be among people. And it was very befitting that his friend Gladstone got him a position when he was in his mid-50s as Lord-in-Waiting for Queen Victoria. And I can imagine that it must have been a blast to have him sitting at the table and rambling about historic details. And he was known to be knowing everything. So his library comprehended 70,000 books, very, very many of whom he had read. You can trace that by looking into the books where he had marked things and stuff. So he was this extremely erudite man who had a lot of things to tell people, and he was wonderful company, I'm quite sure of that.
Well, here we are in 2020 speaking about Lord Acton. What do you think the lessons, maybe the biggest lesson or the lessons that classical liberals can learn from Lord Acton's ideas today?
Well, there's one quote everybody knows. Even if you don't know Lord Acton, you might have heard of that quote. And it's power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I think that is also today, maybe especially today, a very, very important lesson. I mentioned his friendship with Gladstone, and Gladstone was one of the very rare politicians who would give up power because they had things, convictions, because they had ideas which they were convinced of. Just take the example of Home Rule, where Gladstone wouldn't move and actually lost power in the event because he was convinced that home rule for Ireland would be the right thing to do. And probably Acton was also part of this standing up for convictions which Gladstone displayed. And classical liberals have to stick to this ethos of choosing ideas over power. And just, I don't want to get too political here, but some people from the very broad classical liberal libertarian movement have, for my taste, gotten too close to power sometimes and lost it sticking to their ideas. And they have been willing to sacrifice the idea for the power. And that might work in a short term, but I'm quite sure that in the long term, it's really, really important that at least some of us really stick to their ideas, stand up for them, and are ready to sacrifice power even, if it's necessary, to hold up these ideas, because these ideas have a life of their own, as Acton always showed. And this life is so valuable and has given us this wonderful world of freedom, of tolerance, of openness, of markets, of the rule of law, and so on, which is our home.
That's very interesting, because I know as a former politician, there was always a dilemma about how much you compromise on your classical liberal principles in order to achieve power. But you've got to make sure when you've got that power that you actually are able to pursue your classical liberal agenda. If not, was it worth compromising? And I know probably politicians of all ideologies or who have got an ideological drive would probably say the same thing. So I think that's a very important point that you make there. We're not exactly in the midst of a pandemic. We don't know where we are in a pandemic, whether we're still near the beginning or somewhere near the end, or whether we're stuck right in the middle. Do you think there's anything that Lord Acton wrote or said that is relevant to us as we as classical liberals debate the the impact of the pandemic on the economy, the lockdown, our civil liberties, etc.?
Well, it's not that easy because, of course, at his time, luckily, there was no there had some outbreaks, but nothing comparable to nowadays. But I think there's one important feature about Lord Acton that might play a role in thinking about responses to this threat. Lord Acton was very convinced that morality was something extremely important also for the liberal cause. Also altruism. So he wouldn't have been very good friends with people like Ayn Rand, for example. He was quite the contrary. He thought that liberalism was also always about altruism, always about other people, about building a world where everybody is better off, and that you have an obligation, a duty, to be part of this building a better world. He's a Kantian in that sense too. I mean, that's what comes through Alexandre Vinet and through Kant himself into Acton's mind, that he has very high moral standards. And I think that is something we also have to consider in this situation where people's lives are actually threatened. And we have to very carefully think about where we oppose what measures that might in other contexts be ridiculous for us or even threatening for us, but where it's very difficult to get the balance between safety and liberty. And of course, we always know that there's a huge threat. Power tends to corrupt if you try to give up some liberty for safety. But we always have to keep in mind the moral responsibility, I'd say, and Acton hopefully would say, for our fellow human beings. And this very delicate situation has to be dealt with from two perspectives, from the perspective of our freedom being preserved, but also from the perspective of lives being saved and our responsibility, our duty to do what is right.
It's very interesting you say that, because I know that there's a number of classical liberals debate this whole relationship between individual liberty, self-interest and responsibility. And quite often our critics criticize us for saying that we believe in self-interest, or they say, well, actually, self-interest equals selfishness. But self-interest doesn't necessarily mean selfishness. It actually means that you are also concerned about your family, your neighbourhood, your community, your wider country. So it's a very interesting debate that it's important that we're reminded of this. Clemens, it's been a fascinating conversation. In coming to an end now, I wonder whether if I'd said to you, sum up for you, or sum up for us, if you like, Lord Acton and his thoughts and his philosophy, in a few sentences or as brief as you want to be, just so our listeners and our viewers can take something away from this conversation.
Well, I think I'd just make four marks of things, of issues he concerned himself with during his lifetime. The first one is progress. He was a big friend of progress, coming from the Whig tradition and those lines of thought. And he thought that progress is the way of liberty. So liberty is progressing. Sometimes it seems dark, but in the big picture, progress can be believed and we can trust in progress. The second bullet point would be power, which was one of his major themes. And power is, for him, the biggest enemy of liberty. And it can sneak in, it can grow like a cancer, and you have to be very, very weary of power being a threat to liberty. The third thing is conscience. Conscience was, for him, the guarantor of liberty. So if you have something that really guarantees that liberty is preserved, it's the conscience, because that's the thing inside yourself where nobody else can get into, where nobody can actually influence you, where you are yourself, or as Acton would put it, yourself with God. And the fourth point is morality, which is, for him, the order of liberty. So you cannot have liberty without having moral standards and moral convictions. That would be a very brief sum of his thinking, I think.
Well, Clemens Schneider, that's a wonderful place to end, I think. Clemens Schneider, director of Promethea Think Tank and scholar of Lord Acton, thank you very much for joining us today to discuss Lord Acton.
Thank
you very much to our viewers and listeners for joining us today. If you would like more information on our publications, our webinars and our other online content, please check out our YouTube channel, IA London, or listen out for our podcasts on Podbean. And to help us keep providing free content during these tough times, please do consider making a contribution, no matter how modest, by donating online at ia.org.uk. Thank you for watching or listening today, and we hope that you'll be able to join us again soon.